Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Hi, everybody. Up first today, New York City mayoral hopeful Anthony Weiner as we continue to rotate through the candidates. Hey there. Thanks for coming back on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian.
And before we even get to the mayoral campaign, can I get your reaction today as big health reform advocate to the Obama administration announcement that they will delay the employer mandate in Obamacare for a year until 2015? Do you support the decision?
Well, I'm troubled by it. I mean, look, this if you remember at the end of the negotiations on health care reform, it all came down to the Senate making a bunch of changes that a lot of us weren't crazy about, and it was a kind of a take-it-or-leave-it situation. For your listeners to understand, the idea is we not only are requiring individual citizens to get health insurance, but we're making sure that employers don't get a free ride and that any of the time they have more than 50 employees, they have to either provide insurance or pay for what it costs to pay to get those people insurance. The problem with the way it was structured is when you have a number like 50 and they say full-time employees, people are disincentivized for hiring the 51st worker, or they're incentivized to have part-time workers if they're trying to avoid providing insurance. Now, this was a structural thing that a lot of us talked about. I seem to recall I even talked about it on your show. And so it is a legitimate concern. We don't want to encourage people to have part-time workers. It's a relatively small number of companies. You know, despite the conventional wisdom and what a lot of right-wingers say, you know, people want to provide health insurance and they want to get health insurance when it's offered. So although it's a relatively small number of companies that are not going to provide insurance, I still am a little bit concerned. And then there is this kind of process concern. Whenever it's an administration, whether it's a Democrat one that I like or a Republican one that I don't like, whenever they start saying we're not going to enforce parts of a law that the legislature passed, I just think it's a very pernicious thing, and I think it's something that if there's ever a Republican administration, I'm going to be concerned about them picking and choosing the parts of a law they want to implement. But for most New Yorkers, hopefully it won't have a big impact because in addition to us being able to – individuals being able to get insurance up on the exchange beginning in January – as some of your listeners may know, I have proposed restructuring the way we spend our money on health care in New York City to provide a single-payer fallback for New York City residents that hopefully will cover everybody.
And I'll get to that in a minute and give you a chance to talk about it. But do you think, as many of the analysts are saying, that the Obama administration just instituted this delay for a year to get past the 2014 elections because they don't want to have press coverage next year of companies that actually – do decline to hire that 50th worker, or send their workforces into part time status? I guess the Republicans would say that's already happening.
Well, I don't think that it's about politics. I think one of the things that the administration said, to their credit, they've said to critics, and they said, listen, this is a big change that we're doing here. The Medicare Act, after Medicare was installed, went through dozens of changes to tweak it and to fine-tune it, and it's still going through changes. And to their credit, despite the Republicans have kind of said both things. You're shoving a one-size-fits-all down the throats of the states, and on the other side, you said now that they're listening to some of those concerns, they're saying, all right, you're showing that the thing doesn't work. The real big news of next year is that millions of Americans, 30 million Americans will be suddenly able to get hopefully affordable health care by, if they can't afford it themselves, they're going to be getting subsidies to buy insurance. All of us are going to benefit because right now those people are getting health care, but we're paying for it through hospital emergency rooms. So I think the real news of 2014 is a lot of people who said that the sky was going to fall when all these people started getting insurance. It's going to turn out that that's not the case. So I don't really think this is about politics. I think this is about a legitimate concern that critics who hated Obamacare to begin with, and even people like me who thought that there were mistakes that needed to get fixed, both kind of flagged this early on, and unfortunately I think they decided that they'd rather postpone it rather than try to fix it all at once now.
One more thing on this then. How would you fix this problem? Is it about not setting the minimum at 50 workers? Is it about changing the rule in some other way? How do you fix the problem that you identified?
I think that what you'd like to do is you'd like to take the percentage of the payroll you spent on health care. that's the way to do it. Like, we know that if you have X number of employees, you should have, you know, 10, 15, 20% of your payroll should be spent on healthcare. This way you get around the part-time, full-time. You still encourage people to grow because you make it a percentage of your payroll. So if you add more employees, you still are paying the same amount. That's the way we would have liked it structured on the House side, and many progressive folks who were talking about how you incentivize it, that would be the smarter way to do it. Rather than say a hard number and a certain type of worker, you say employers have to have a certain percentage of their payroll has to go towards health care. And also it's much easier to certify because it's a dollar amount and you can audit it and see that it's really happening. That would have been the way to structure it the first time.
Then it would have had to cover all employers, regardless of whether they had 50 or 5 employees?
No, I think it was always intended that we didn't want to have a big paperwork burden on the smallest of employers, most employers. We didn't want to create a regime that made this more of a burden than it needed to be. For those workers, and frankly, it's the overwhelming number of them, for those workers, we would still probably have an exemption for small businesses. We just would have structured it differently. Rather than the number of workers, we would have put it at the size of their payroll or something like that. I mean, the biggest challenge here is when you say 50 full-time workers, there is an incentive to make the 51st worker a part-time worker, which is a trend going on in the economy anyway that we don't want to accelerate.
Former Congressman and mayoral hopeful Anthony Weiner. In your campaign, you've spoken about a kind of single-payer health system for New York City, as you just indicated. You want to take a minute and tell us how that would work?
Yeah, it's a simple principle. We, the city of New York, pay about $15 billion each year for health care. Where are we spending it? Well, it's primarily for workers, for retirees, for people we pay for Medicaid. We've got a Health and Hospitals Corporation. We've got a Department of Health. We have a lot of people who are uninsured that we pay for through various ways. And the problem is that we never see that as an opportunity. We only see it as a cost. We keep writing checks to insurance companies who take their 15 or 20% off the top. We never see it as a way to encourage job opportunity and growth. We never use that money to try to influence people to keep hospitals open rather than to close them. We never use that money to make sure it goes back into local, say, community pharmacies and community doctors rather than go off somewhere else. And so what I have suggested is that for the first time, we take that amount of money and we try to control it in-house. And there's a couple of ways you can do that. We can either say to insurance companies, okay, since we have so much marketing strength, we're going to demand a much better bargain. A second thing is to structure something like Medicare here for New York. You know, unlike other localities, we have hospitals, we have nursing facilities, we have thousands of doctors we employ. We have the ability to do this. And it's basically seeing a third element that doesn't get viewed by the mayor, and that is see this as an opportunity. We should not sit back passively and watch hospitals close when our single largest employer, particularly of middle-class jobs, are in the healthcare profession. So, there's a portion of the budget that the mayor every year refers to as non-controllable. That portion, healthcare, goes up 40% in the next 4 years. That's the toughest part of giving raises to our workers, is that healthcare expenses are so high. So not only do I hope to have better coverage, but I also hope to be able to save money that we can then use for other important things.
Does the term single payer mislead people as to what this is? Those details that you laid out all sound very interesting. But single payer in Canada means the government is everyone's payer and everyone is taxed for it. There's no private insurance. So is single payer really the right name for what you're proposing for New York?
Well, you don't need to look to Canada for a single payer system. We have one called Medicare in the United States of America that works pretty darn well. It has less than a 1.5% overhead. It provides care for the oldest and therefore sickest Americans. And they do so fairly efficiently. I mean, frankly.
But basically, every American over 65 is on Medicare. Not every New Yorker would be on this. There'd be still so many New Yorkers with private insurance, unless they're in one of those categories that you mentioned that falls through the cracks.
No, we have basically two experiments going on in the country at once. One is the private employer-based model, and frankly, Obamacare kind of doubles down on that. And the other is the many people, about 40% of Americans, who get Medicare or Medicaid, which are single-payer systems. The single-payer, and this is a misnomer to believe that we're going to hire all the doctors, this is not about health care provision. This is about how we're going to pay for it most efficiently. And we have big inherent inefficiencies in the employer-based model. We're basically paying insurance companies to take our money and then give it to doctors and give it to nurses and give it to hospitals. I want to turn that script on its head and say, listen, if we're the city of New York, we have all these healthcare resources. What do we really need insurance companies to be doing? What value are they adding to the formula? So while some people would say, oh, it's the Canada system or the British system, no, it's the most American system imaginable, which is Medicare. I guess the best way to look at this is this is for city workers, for the uninsured, for retirees. This would be Medicare for all New Yorkers who are eligible. Mm-hmm. But I'd also going to try to expand this to cover the undocumented who are not going to be covered under Obamacare, yet who are going to cost us a great deal of money if we don't figure out a way to cover them.
And have you costed it out as to whether it'll cost more or less or the same as what the city pays now to cover all those groups or pay for health care in one way or another for all those groups?
If it costs more, then it ain't working. The whole idea of this is to be able to save money. I mean, right now we have a 40% increase between now and 2017 just to cover city workers. And to tell you why that's so important, you know, if we were to give teachers a raise 1 year, 4%, it would cost us about $900 million. That 1 year of health care, $1.3 billion. So what's happening is that our health care costs are eating away at everything else we want to do in the city. So in answer to your question, I primarily started to look at this as a cost savings idea, but frankly, I think it's also going to be able to increase access. Remember the strange math of healthcare. If you expand access to insurance, to coverage for citizens, we save money. That's why Obamacare saves money over the long term, because it's cheaper to provide someone with coverage to get preventative care, to get care outside the emergency room, rather than to simply mop up when we're done.
And since one of your ways for paying for this is to require that all municipal employees pay something into their health care premiums, and if they smoke, 25% more. Do you think you're going to get any public sector votes? Other people are getting the public sector union endorsements. Are you afraid of scaring away a lot of those voters who turn out in great numbers?
Look, what I'm trying to do in this campaign is to structure it in a different way, is to not simply look at different interest groups and different institutions and try to build a campaign on endorsements. It's to have a real mature conversation about the challenges our city faces. Most city workers and the overwhelming number of union leaders recognize that we need to do something to get health care costs under control. It's in the interest of workers that they not have to sit down at the bargaining table every single year and say, okay, I will take a 1% raise because I've had a 15% increase in the cost of health care. So I think people understand that and get that. But the deal I'm hoping to make with workers is to say, look, I'm going to try to reduce the cost, but also we all have to recognize we want to have a little bit of skin in the game. If for no other reason, then study after study has shown that even if workers pay a small amount, they become much more informed consumers. And also the sense of fairness in the private sector, if you're getting any coverage at all, you're paying 30, 35%. State workers pay 25%. Federal workers pay 30%. I'm suggesting a smaller amount that the policy will cost, and I'm asking city workers, as is what I'm proposing, obviously we're going to have to negotiate this, pay 10%, retirees pay 10%, and if you smoke, you pay a little bit more. I think that's a fair conversation to have, and so far I have been encouraged by the number of people who say to me, listen, we know we haven't had this tough conversation, but that's what campaigns are about, and that's why we need some change at City Hall, because we need to figure out how we manage health care. We can't be just the tail of the dog of health care. We have to realize we have to control our fate and try to lean into this problem.
Mayoral hopeful Anthony Weiner with us on WNYC. I see you're holding a news conference today on New York City independence from Albany. How do you think the city is too much? And I know there are all kinds of ways. They control our rent laws. They control all kinds of things. How do you think the city is too much under the control of the state, most importantly?
Well, I think we need to take a step back and realize there might have been a time in our city's past and in Albany's past where you said, you know what, we can't govern ourselves. We need the help of Big Brother in Albany to help govern our affairs. I don't think anyone who is even casually watching the change that's going on in the last 40 years, in the last 30 years, can see that now that is different. Now it's the city of New York that, frankly, is providing, you know, leadership and whatever your politics are. We've shown that this city can be governed. But still, so much of our lives, so much more than I think most citizens realize, are under the control of Albany. everything from the control of the MTA board to how Ground Zero is going to be developed. I'll give you an example. If you have a neighborhood shopping strip and someone wants to open up a bar or restaurant and apply for a liquor license, the state liquor authority in Albany has to sign off on it. Our rent laws, whether you think our rent should go up or down or sideways, our rent laws are going to expire in 2015. And Republicans in the state Senate are going to hold our fate in their hands just like they did in the past. Even minor things. We, every year, argue whether we should have more or fewer charter schools. We can have that argument in a different conversation. But why is it Albany making that decision and not the city of New York?
So are you proposing some kind of broad self-rule bill, or what are you proposing?
Well, here's what I'm proposing, that the next mayor has to have this as part of his or her everyday agenda, which is pushing back on Albany's control. We have gotten into this very bad place that we all kind of shrug our shoulders and say, yeah, that's just the way it is. I think that there's always got to be a healthy tension between Albany and New York City. And in the past, people said, well, these things will never change. Well, we said that for generations about the control of the school system. And to the mayor's credit, we now have not as much control as we should, but we have a lot of control over that. So I guess what I'm saying, I'm using the 4th of July, actually the day before, so I don't ruin anyone's picnic plan. The 4th of July to talk about, our Declaration of Independence, and just to get New Yorkers having this discussion. Another thing about elections that we miss out on is there should be times we take a step back and not only think about, who's up and who's down, but think about what kind of a city we aspire to be. And hopefully the next mayor will take these issues and say, we're just not going to accept that this continues to be this way. We're going to try to change it.
We have a few minutes left. Let me go through a few other things pretty briefly on stop and frisk. We talked on the show yesterday about Mayor Bloomberg's remark that the police stop too many white people and not enough minorities based on who's stopped versus who statistically commits violent crime. Bill Thompson and Bill de Blasio have gotten most of the coverage for expressing outrage at the remark. Were you outraged, too?
Yeah. I mean, look, I just think that the mayor does a great disservice to how important this conversation is and to how people feel about it to make such an insensitive remark. And I have to tell you that Mayor Bloomberg deserves credit. Many of us forgotten after Giuliani, racial tensions in the city were very high, and a lot of the mayor's efforts at tone have made things better. The mayor is making a fundamental logical mistake. It's not the percentages that are as important as the raw numbers. When you have 700,000 or so people getting stopped compared to 80 or 90,000 during the Giuliani years, the number of people who were being stopped who did absolutely nothing wrong, those people read comments like the mayor made and says he just doesn't understand the damage that this is doing, but it's doing damage in a way that I'm not sure that the mayor understands. It's creating an environment of distrust in the communities that is leading people, particularly people of color who are being stopped overwhelmingly, to just not be as trusting as the police. It's making policing more difficult for their officers. And the mayor also makes one other important mistake. If he stopped everybody, he would probably find some crimes. He'd probably find some guns. If you take his argument to the logical extension, he should stop every single human being on the streets. But the police are not using the test of reasonable suspicion. They're stopping people wantonly to fill out 250s in their books, and the mayor doesn't seem to understand just how corrosive this policy is, and that's why his statements are so regrettable.
All right. We've talked politics all this time. Policy all this time. Two political questions before you go. Many people were surprised to see you tied with or ahead of Christine Quinn with women in the recent polls, considering why you resigned from Congress. Can you make an explicit argument to women voters why you would be better for their interests than Christine Quinn or anyone else as mayor?
One of the things I've tried to do with my ideas that I've got up on my website where we roll out every day or so to talk about the middle class and those struggling to make it is to make it clear that there are unifying things in our city. That for too long campaigns have been to stare at a pie of New York City and chop up people until you get to 51%. When I talk about our single-payer healthcare system, I think women and men who care about the economy, who care about bringing up our kids, respond to that. When I talk about the notion of restoring some sense of discipline and getting back to basics in the classroom and honoring teachers rather than lecturing them, something that my mother, a 31-year school teacher, talks about a lot, I think people respond to that. I also think that all New Yorkers, I think, sometimes get dishonored by the way we run campaigns. You know, if they just become conversations about politics and who's up and who's down, or three or four, you know, slogans, then I think that people don't listen. I think what's happening in this campaign is that I'm trying to do things differently. You know, I'm trying to say, listen, if you know, my opponents have been in city government a long time. If people like the way things are going, they have many options they can choose from. If they want to have a new type of discussion with a foundation in ideas for the middle class and those struggling to make it, I want to be there to have that conversation. And
so you don't want to say anything about why you'd be a good mayor for women's interests, because you don't want to go down that different identity groups path at all?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm leaving it to citizens to decide the issues that they find are important, and I want to be there to have a conversation with them. I think the challenge of creating workforce, middle-class housing in our city is one that transcends gender identity. It transcends even economic identity. I think even very wealthy people realize we have to do that. And I'm trying to do things different, Brian. And I'm just trying not to go to different communities and different interest groups and make different arguments, but I think what ultimately winds up happening is that citizens look to their left and look to their right and see how much common interest that we have, and that someone's speaking to those aspirations. And I think that's why we're doing well.
And last political question, looking forward to primary day, I wonder if you have plans to get large numbers of your potential supporters to the polls. That turned out to be some of the core genius in the Obama reelection campaign, as you know, driven by that big data but very precise data. And now that Quinn, Thompson, de Blasio, and Lou all have some significant unions lining up to help with get-out-the-vote efforts, and with low voter turnout generally in Democratic mayoral primaries in recent years, what's your primary day plan?
Well, you know, I think the single thing that animates voters to going to the polls is voters feel animated to go to the polls. They feel that something important is at stake. They feel like something exciting is happening. You know, people talk about the number crunching of 2012, but also what it comes down to is a lot of Americans realized in 2008 and 2012 that these are important decisions about the direction of our city. And what we're finding is that, you know, when I got in the race, the number of people who jumped off the sideline and volunteered and started telling pollsters that they're excited about the race again, the number of people who tell these surveys they're more committed to my campaign because we're talking about real ideas. I mean, look,
didn't the Obama campaign prove that you can't do it just through media and advertising? You need to have workers on the ground contacting individuals who are identified as potential wiener voters and reminding them and getting commitments to turn out?
Listen, I'm sure the Obama camp had very important ways of trying to get voters in Pennsylvania on one side of the street that they wanted to vote as opposed to the other side. I'm trying to do something different. I'm trying to talk to New York City residents and getting them excited about what's happening. I remember when people lined up in 2008 to cast a vote for President Obama, I don't think it was because they had been identified as reading a certain type of a magazine or it had a union call them. They were excited because they knew how important the election was. We've had 12 years of we have 24 years since we've elected a Democrat. And sometimes I believe it's because Democrats haven't deserved to win because we haven't constructed campaigns that excite people. I believe the members of these individual unions are going to want to vote for me because they care about the challenges facing the middle class. They want ideas-based campaigns. They want to fix our health care system. They want to get the basics back in education. And I believe that those unions were going to call all their members. Those members are going to say, oh, yeah, I remember that guy Weiner talked about some important issues that I cared about. I'm going to go vote for him for mayor.
Anthony Weiner, running for mayor. We'll keep talking. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
As we continue to rotate through all the mayoral candidates and the New Jersey Senate candidates here on The Brian Lehrer Show. Coming up next, a perspective on the George Zimmerman trial from Patricia Williams, Columbia University law professor, also known as the Mad Law Professor in The Nation magazine. Some people think the prosecution has already lost this case. I suspect Patricia Williams disagrees. We'll find out.